We're going to hear from yet another very experienced person in her particular field, Maria Jockel, who's an immigration lawyer. Now, I was fascinated when I saw this subject because I thought, it's one thing I know a little bit about, or used to know a little bit about, it was the immigration situation and policies and things that brought it into existence. But Maria is a bit different from that. She's much more experienced and much more imbued with the law, obviously, being a lawyer. She's currently leader of Russell Kennedy's immigration law team, and you have to be pretty good to be doing that. In her current and former roles, Ms. Jockel has contributed to shaping the future of immigration law in Australia. She's far too young to have shaped the future of immigration law in Australia when I had anything to do with it. But she has advised on sensitive government policy and legal matters at both the state and the federal levels. She acts for international and Australian corporations, bringing skilled personnel to Australia to meet labour force needs. Ms. Jockel also advises international education providers on requirements of the national code and regulatory compliance with dealing with student visa matters. She represents business, skilled and family migrants, advising in all aspects of temporary and permanent residency. So when anybody comes to you and says, how do I get to stay in Australia, which they frequently do, strangely enough, you say, go and see Maria Jockel. I generally say go and see your local federal member because they have access to the immigration department, and the immigration department should take at least some notice of propositions put to them by members of parliament. They don't always do that, but sometimes they do. Because I get intrigued when we start talking about immigration, because we are all immigrants or the descendants of immigrants. And I look our Indigenous brothers straight in the eye and say, you too are immigrants in the first instance. You came down over the land bridge into Australia many, many years before we all did, but nevertheless, all Australians of whatever background are immigrants or the descendants of immigrants. And of course, we are a nation of, I would say, peculiar reputation in terms of the capacity to integrate people from so many different countries around the world into our society. I strongly use the word integrate rather than assimilate, because you still hear it said, and what we're trying to do is get a integration so that we get the best aspects of everybody's background. But the people that Maria has a particular interest and expertise relating to are those coming here for an education. And they are of extraordinary importance to Australia, to the states, and to themselves, so that they either learn a tremendous amount here and go back to their countries of origin and add greatly to the development of those countries, or in many cases they stay on in Australia and add greatly to the development of this country. There used to be a tremendous discussion about the brain drain. It was quite wrong for Australia to be bringing in people who were the best and brightest of the countries that they were coming from, because this was depriving those countries of these people of high intellectual quality. I never really accepted that, because I think that what people did was come here to develop their own capacities, to develop their own intellectual capacity to deal with what the subject that they were most interested in. And I think so many have gone back and finished up in positions of high importance in governments, in politics, in running departments, and in the various fields of activity that they've taken up. So we're lucky that we've got Maria here, because she knows about these things and she can give us the background to it. And I'm sure at the appropriate time answer any questions that people may have in relation to what is and can be a very complex and very challenging area of public policy, that is anything to do with immigration. So would you please welcome Maria Jockel.
Thank you very much. There's an enormous amount that I want to cover, and I'm going to bore you with a lot of information, but I've learnt that information is power. Please don't assume anything about my own perspective. One of the things that I found very interesting in regard to being educated, or living and being educated in Australia, is that we have a phenomenal capacity to access information. It's publicly available. Because we have such a complex society, it's very difficult to sometimes get access to certain information. I'm going to give you a personal perspective and take of it what you will. Now, obviously, my role as an immigration lawyer is to focus on immigration law, and within that, migration, the education industry, and what this means for Australia. But I think that it would be important for me to put this into context so that you understand my perspective. What I'd like to do is just give you a quick overview on Australia's migration regulatory environment, because only if you understand how the law and the agents, broadly speaking, work in the industry, are you going to understand what this means for the purposes of the migration program, and then within that understand the importance of international education as part of Australia's migration program, and what that means in terms of the current review by government in regard to international education, the push-pull dynamic we have in regard to international education, and then finally some conclusions which include the challenges that we face as a nation of immigrants and one that is part of a global economy. So if I can, please, I hope that I don't bore you, but it's only if you understand the complex regime that we're a part of will you understand where I'm coming from as an immigration law specialist. Now, in 1989, the Migration Act was a few sections. Now it is 3,000 pages of law, 16,000 pages of policy, being policy directives created by the department in Canberra which guide case officers in regard to the exercise of their discretion, 152 visa categories, 9 bridging visa categories, and it's subject to constant and dynamic change. It is second in complexity to the taxation legislation, and in my view, just as important, while taxation raises revenue, migration program is a policy which is fundamentally essential to Australia. Not only are we a nation of immigrants, but today the migration program is a population policy. It is a skilling policy and is actually the cornerstone of Australia's economic prosperity. And I'll touch upon why that is the case. So we have a very complex legislative regime which is dynamic and subject to constant change because, of course, it's a political regime. It reflects the government's policies of the day. We've had a program which has gone from White Australia program all the way now to a more inclusive and open program, but one which is strictly legalistic codified and highly legalistic. As I say, it's in response to the policies of the government of the day, and we know that government policies can change. And I'll touch upon some of the things that affect the international education area. Very few of you would be aware of the fact that the Department of Immigration, I think in 2009, had 22 million customers. 22 million customers. That's the population of Australia. What the Secretary of the Department means by that, it's all the people that come in through transit, you know, the international arrivals and departures, the visitors, which we have over 5 million of them, the working holiday visa makers, we have nearly a million of them, the international students, we have over 650,000 international students in Australia currently. The 457 visa holders, which with their dependents are about 100,000 people. The unlawfuls, which they guesstimate are about 60,000, but they're not absolutely sure because they're predominantly Caucasian and they fit in very effectively with the community. And so we go on. No one actually knows that the Department of Immigration receives 13,000 applications a day. How do I know that? I ring Canberra. I get a voicemail. And it's a recording, and it tells me that amongst the services of the department is that they straddle 13,000 applications a day. They offer settlement services, they offer citizenship services, and so they go on. It is a phenomenal undertaking, and yet there's only 7,000 bureaucrats, and they service both Australia and, of course, our overseas posts, and we are part of a global village. So the role of the Department of Immigration is extraordinarily dynamic, and whilst, of course, as a department, we all know that they have had their failings, and we've all remembered the Palmer and Comey reports, which are the excesses of bureaucratic power, which is not appropriately balanced, and I'm going to talk about that in a minute as well. But the fact is, it's an extraordinary task that a nation as big as America, with the extraordinary wealth that we have, the affluence, no acid rain, so far no nuclear mishaps, reasonably good climate, okay, we've got, you know, a lot of arid land, etc. A welcoming nation. We have, I believe, over 260 ethnic groups, over 220 languages spoken. Melbourne has been voted consistently as one of the most livable cities in the world, etc. We're affluent. We have virtually full workforce participation. Even when things are bad for us, it's still very good relative to a lot of the other world. We're just rather indulged, if I may say so. We're used to being the lucky country. We're a country which is sought after. We don't need Mr. Hogan on the Sydney Harbour Bridge to sell Australia. We're on the map. And clients no longer ask me whether kangaroos jumped down Bourke Street. They realise we're a sophisticated, affluent nation, which is inclusive, it's multicultural, it's pluralistic. We cater to an enormous range of political ideologies, ethnic groups and perspectives on life. So no wonder half the world wants to come here, at least as a safe haven, not necessarily to stay, but as insurance from other regimes which don't offer them the same sort of security. So it is not a wonder that we get 13,000 applications a day across 152 visa categories. And do you realise that in 2003 the Department of Immigration, I think, made about 300 odd million by way of revenue? Would you like to know what they did in 2007? 670 million. Would you like to know what they're going to do in this financial year? Over $1 billion. So I am part of one of the biggest businesses in the Commonwealth of Australia, short of the tax department. I help to generate independent revenue for the Commonwealth. And it is, in fact, a very important business for the Commonwealth of Australia. International education, as we know, is a fundamental revenue earner at both Commonwealth and state level. So what does all of this mean? Well, obviously, when you're very, very popular, you take advantage of it. And if you go into www.imi.gov.au, you've got a wonderful departmental website, which is over 5,000 pages, and which gives you an introductory into Australia's migration program. It is very welcoming, but if you're a little bit cynical, read between the lines. It's a bit like, don't call us, we'll call you. And if you want to apply, you can apply on a credit card. Okay? Now, am I jaundiced? Yes, I am. Because we lawyers lost the Cunliffe challenge. It was a High Court challenge which was fought in about 1992. When the government of the day, Labor, bless them, and don't take anything from that comment, I work with all sides of politics, and my own politics is my own business. But they brought in what was a fundamentally dual regulation. In defence of wanting to regulate the migration advice profession, we lawyers are now dual regulated. What that means is that I pay $400 to the Law Institute of Victoria for the privilege of practising as a lawyer, and I pay the Office of the Migration Agents Registration Authority, which is an arm of the Department of Immigration, $1,595. There are 4,300 migration agents in Australia. The average life of a migration agent is 3 years. It's a revolving door. They all offer you money back guarantees if they're there in 3 years' time or whatever it is. No disrespect to any migration agents here tonight. But I'm dual regulated, and what that means is that of the 4,300 registered migration agents, of which I'm one, and my colleague Jennifer Lee is another who works with me, who's a budding immigration lawyer, we pay two sets of levies, one to our State Law Society and one to the Office of the Migration Agents Registration Authority. Why do we allow non-lawyers to practice law in something as fundamentally important as immigration law?
Mm. Mm. Good question.
And why are we changing the Migration Act so that non-permanent residents, non-citizens can become migration agents? Why do we have offshore registered migration agents? What extraterritoriality does Australia have to regulate people offshore, other than to give them a banner to say, I'm regulated by the Commonwealth of Australia, so you can trust me, come and give me some of your money? Because after all, we're part of a global business. The nature of the 21st century is business. I mean, that's not just pervasive in capitalism, it's in most market economies, and we're finding that even in China, which is an unusual experiment in terms of a combination of capitalism and socialism. So I have a real concern about the fact that there has been absolutely no political will by any government of the day to look at the regulation of the migration advice profession and what that means. I should retract that, the migration advice industry. I do not think it's a profession. You can do a course over 5 weekends and pay $10,000 to become a registered migration agent. It's only recently, by virtue of the lobbying of the Law Council of Australia, and I'm on one of the executive committees, that we immigration lawyers, those with current practicing certificates, are finally being noted on the Office of Migration Agents Registration Authority website, that I am a lawyer with a current practicing certificate, and that means that I've got an audited trust account, professional indemnity, etc. It took us 20 years to get that recognition. Why does the government not want to make a distinction between lawyer and non-lawyer agents? If the aim of the dual regulation system is to raise professional standards, to protect consumers, and to maintain the integrity of Australia's migration program, which is fundamentally important to nationhood, why do we not encourage lawyers who, if they do the wrong thing, lose practicing certificates? Why do we not encourage more lawyers to practice immigration law? It is an exceedingly complex area of law. You cannot dabble in it. If you are a lawyer, it is a job for life. Once you've worked out how you get your way through the maze, it is a labyrinth. It is an exciting, wonderful area of law because you are actually helping Australia. You're growing nationhood. As I said, it's a population policy. We have zero population growth, declining workforce participation and ageing population. We're heading in the same direction as Italy and half the European world, China and where Japan is now. We don't have enough workers. We need immigration. We cannot populate sufficiently to be able to meet our own workforce needs. And as soon as the mining boom and the gas and other resource boom fully hits us, what we're going to have is the East Coast is going to go to the West Coast, and we're going to be left without any skilled labour. We're going to have not only a skilled labour shortage, we're going to have a labour shortage, which is what we experienced before the GFC. We've got a finite capacity to employ those 2 million people that are in some form social security recipients. My own view is that in a society we've got a spectrum. It ranges from the very top to the very bottom. In the middle you've got the average. And anyone below the average is less likely to be able to be upskilled and employed, no matter how much you try. Whether they want to or they don't want to, there's a finite capacity in a society. So we are globally competitive. We punch way above our weight. Our population fits into the city of Shanghai. That is an extraordinary achievement. Extraordinary. And we started off as a penal colony. Look at how far you can go. And all of us are migrants from anywhere and everywhere. This is my fifth country. I grew up in displaced persons camps. Not that I normally share that in a public situation. I'm a very, very private person. But I'm very blessed. My mother had a choice of Canada, America and Australia. She chose America. Chose Australia, not America. When she came here, she regretted her choice. She said she'd come to the end of the earth. But she got used to it. And this became her beloved haven. And both all of my two siblings, we've all been university educated. Where else is that possible for a young nation of migrants, which is what we are? We're collectively haven't been around here for very long. So I'm extremely enthusiastic about what Australia is. I think it's a fantastic country. I'm very pleased to be an Australian. I don't care what you call me. You can call me a WOG. I'm very happy to answer to that. I recognise that I have a dual heritage, and somehow or other the fates chose me to do immigration law. Now, I've got a double honours degree. And I did extremely well in subjects like tax and equity and company and whatever, but hella, I ended up in immigration law. If anyone's interested in law, it's a fantastic area of law. Black letter law, extremely complex, overlaid by policy, fantastic advocacy skills, and you meet people. And you meet people all the way. I worked with the largest antiquity collector of the world, an ex-Palestinian gentleman, with offices in Bond and in Rodeo Drive, all the way to people who are refugee claimants that we help on a pro bono basis in accordance with a pro bono program. So that's enough about me. If any of you are interested in the migration advice profession, I would urge you to agitate that government take care of it. Because why? And now I'm going to talk to you about international education. International education is something that grew. We have been selling international education for 15 years. In the last 10 or so years, we've become rather polished about it. And then Mr. Ruddick, who was the longest-serving Minister of Immigration, had a brilliant idea. In the early 2000s, he decided that those international students that had graduated in Australia would be able to apply for permanent residency. At that time, the rules were very, very finite. And there was what was called Schedule 1 criteria. So it was very time-based. If you didn't have this, you didn't have this, you didn't have this, you just missed the boat. You didn't get a chance. Over time, successive legislative and policy changes resulted in that being watered down. And what's happened is since then, we've had a complete shift from I'm in Australia to be educated and maybe I might qualify for residency if I'm lucky, to a whole range of interest groups coming together, taking advantage of loopholes and unintended consequences of the regulatory and policy framework to create a formidable industry. It's called international education. Why is it formidable? Well, it's Victoria's largest export earner. And it's the Commonwealth's third largest export earner. You think about that. We're competing with iron ore and coal. I mean, they are incredible areas of need. So in that context, it is a very, very important part of the Australian economy. But we've got to be very careful, because what we've learned historically is that it can be rorted, it can be abused, it can result in our reputation being tarnished internationally. Because any program which encourages many people to come to Australia to study, and with often a vain, underline, vain hope of residency, is a mismatch between expectations and outcome. Now, why do our regulators, why have they taken until Chris Evans, when he actually made an announcement at the end of, I think it was 2009, early 2010, to say there is a disconnect between education and visa outcomes? Why did it take that long? Well, obviously, government policy is like a juggernaut. It's a bit like shifting the Titanic. It takes a while to get the message through. Also, when you think about joined up government is not very effectively joined up. The education framework, the regulatory framework, falls within the Department of Education and Employment and Workplace Relations. Julia Gillard's previous department went, you know, she was the super lady, and she was able to straddle all of that divide. They regulate the Educational Services of Overseas Students Act, and that's the act which determines whether an international education provider can be registered as a CRICROSS education provider. So when you see CRICROSS, you see that particular education provider can sell that course to international students. But as well as the role of DUA, you've then got the Department of Immigration and Citizenship, which is the department which determines whether you get a visa. Because if you don't get a visa, you can't come to Australia to study, so there's no deal. Then you've got the state regulators, and in each state we've got our own regulators. And they all have their own perceptions of whether a provider is risky. And where the problem arose, if I can go back a bit, is we go back to Mr. Ruddick, and Mr. Ruddick allowed international students who'd completed their studies in Australia to be eligible to apply for residency, and that got easier and easier. Then the government, which I'm talking about the Department of Immigration, decided that they were concerned that perhaps the wrong calibre of students were applying for permanent residency at the conclusion of their stay, and that they were not getting the highly skilled cohort that they wanted wanted to ameliorate Australia's skill shortages and to help us to grow our nation. So in September 2007, they changed what's called the General Skilled Migration Program. And that's the program under which an international student who's finished their studies in Australia can apply for permanent residency without having to leave the country. They used occupations on the Migration Occupations in Demand list, which was a list of both professional and trade occupations which were in short supply, and they thought that the way that they would manage the demand is that they would say that the students would have to also, if they were to get the requisite points in certain occupations, they'd have to have relevant Australian work experience for at least 12 months post their initial qualification. Well, what happened was this. Some very clever operators looked at the migration occupations in demand list, saw cookery or commercial hospitality, and they saw hairdressing. So what happened, there was a plethora of private education providers which became established throughout Australia, which in conjunction with migration agents, and there's a lot of unregistered migration agents. Okay, so the 4,300 is only the ones that are registered. Then the education agents, those that we know of and those that work underground and just get a commission for introducing somebody to a particular education provider. And I'm talking about both onshore and offshore. So this is a global business. I'm not exaggerating. So you've got all of these people coming to and they look at the stuff and they work out the visa rules and they say, well, hey, this is a wonderful proposition. So you go and tout, and we have education fairs. Our education providers, be they public or private, have fairs globally, because after all, it's a global industry. You may know that international education is a global industry of the 21st century. So they go and sell international education, and I make no comments about the calibre of the providers or whether the students do or do not achieve the sort of education outcomes that they want. But they go out there, it's a profit-motivated industry. Education is now basically profit. It props up the international education sector. It now accounts for about 30% of the revenue of the education sector across Australia. It's a very, very rough revenue. Don't hold me to my figures. I'm just giving you generalisations. And so what you've got is people basically saying, okay, come to Australia. We're going to give you a visa outcome. And when I go to Canberra and I talk to the Department of Immigration, as I'm privileged to do wearing my law counsel hat, and I show them flyers, you know, that I find off the street or people bring to me, and Fred Bloggs has set up and he's offering you guaranteed education, he's going to give you a skill assessment, he's going to give you work references, he's going to give you permanent residency to Australia, and you say, surely no one is naive to buy that. Yes, they are. How often do we humans want to believe that which is too good to be true? Especially young foreign students who have no knowledge about Australia, most of whom come from other countries and often come from countries in Asia where the family is actually wanting Australia to be used as a safe haven. The student comes here, they study, they may qualify for residency. If they qualify for residency, if they come from a high net worth family, they'll probably go back to their home country and pursue whatever the opportunities are there, but otherwise they may not. So what happened was an enormous anomaly. And Bob Birrell, and I don't always agree with Bob Birrell, but he basically said, how was it that the Department of Immigration granted 58,000 visas to Indian students studying hospitality in Australia? How many cooks do we need? Fair question. So, you know, what happened, and this is my personal take, as I say, it's a personal perspective, it's a potted perspective, it's a very rash generalisation in the time available, by not having a policy setting where government effectively regulated the migration advice industry, coupled with the education advice industry, which is a power unto itself, coupled with the international education providers, plus all the tentacles that feed from that. Otherwise, perhaps, you know, flow-through effects and benefits, hangers-on, whatever else you want to call it. We ended up with a schmozzles. We ended up with lots of Indian students. We had some terrible tragedies, a couple of Indian students that committed suicide. This is very, very serious for Australia. We had students working night shift, being attacked in working class areas, because at the end of the day, you've got one of the most important things that I believe that Australia must do is have public acceptance of our migration policies. If we do not, we are fair game. We are a very heterogeneous society. And unless we maintain popular support, we will always have splinter groups that will cause havoc because of whatever their beliefs might be or their connection might be to their own home country, wherever that hails from. So I've been a great believer that in whatever I do, my intent is not to be alarmist. It's intending to understand the difficulties that arise from public policy when after a while the profit motive takes over, enormous revenues generated from one particular sector, and we end up with a fiasco. So that now what the government has done is that there's a new general point scheme which is coming into effect on the 1st of July. It's intending to basically encourage those international students that have got a deeper skill set to be able to qualify for permanent residency at the conclusion of their stay. But the government now has to deal with a legacy of students who are here. They don't know what to do with them. We have enough people in the general skilled migration program to fill the next 5 years' quota. What do we do with the students coming through and wanting to apply? So that's a policy conundrum that has yet to be determined. But in that context, and I'm sorry if I'm very long-winded in coming up to the crescendo, we now have the Michael Knight program. Visa program, and Michael Knight, and I was privileged to meet him in Sydney on behalf of the Australia-China Business Council, which is another area that I've got an interest in, and Mr. Knight has to walk the line. Mr. Knight has to come up with a solution to what is Australia's visa program. Now, we can't slave a golden goose. After all, it's too important to Australia, isn't it? And we're very good at short-term gain, and we don't see the long-term pain. That seems to be the nature of social and political policy of the government of today. I guess they're not around to take the consequences of their actions, and everyone thinks that we've got failing memories and we're not going to remember what was said to us yesterday. But in any event, Mr. Knight has to look at the quality. Because at the end of the day, the only thing that counts is quality. You've got nothing to sell if it's not quality. That's my badge. If I can't sell myself as a quality immigration lawyer, I'm just another migration agent. And we're a dime a dozen. Integrity. Fundamentally important. Without integrity, you're just selling yourself to the highest bidder or the lowest bidder, depending on what your bargaining position is in the marketplace. And competitiveness. Forget about competitiveness. We are competitive. England has already closed its borders because it can't cope with the rotting that's being caused by international education. And I'm not talking about the top end. I'm talking at the bottom end. We have a 30% of international education props up Australia's educational sector. How many do we want? How sustainable is it? They're questions that you have to think about. America has 3%. So it's something to think about. But in any event, juggling these competing interests, his role is to examine international education sector, look at the strengthening of the integrity of the student visa program, because if you know how to get a... I can tell you how to get a visa, not that I would, but I would know how to milk the system, because once you know a system, you know how to play it. And you can do it a number of ways, either with skill and scare of responsibility, or you can do it for fraudulent documents. And by the way, my guesstimate is that the department spends over $500 million per annum trying to enforce migration law. They're losing the battle because we don't have the resources to catch all the rorters. But in any event, Mr. Knight has to examine and make recommendations on the effective partnership framework that considers the respective roles and responsibilities of key stakeholders. That includes the education providers, all of whom want more international students. Should they have them? Or should we have another way to fund education? Or a complementary way to fund education? And if so, which way? The Department of Immigration and Citizenship, because as I said, if you don't get a visa to Australia, you're not an international student. The Department of Education, Employment and Workplace Relations, which I'm told by my colleagues in the Department of Immigration actually allowed the rot to continue for longer than it should have, because our current Prime Minister was very uncomfortable about upsetting the apple cart. But I think it ended up being more upset. In fact, it toppled over when it came to our relations with the Indian government. And lastly, but not least, the state and territory education regulators. And some of them do allow all sorts of providers to become registered, many that I would never register. So that's one part. The next thing is the appropriateness of the existing threshold requirements for student visa applicants, including English language proficiency, financial capacity and educational qualifications. Are you a genuine student? Are you truly coming here to study, or have you got an ulterior agenda? There's nothing wrong with you coming here to study with the hope of getting residency, but not if you're going to do it at all cost, such as abuse the system, undermine the law, become unlawful, enter into bogus marriages, concoct fraudulent documents, work references, fraudulent qualifications, etc., etc. We've even had international teachers being bribed to doctor the English language tests of students, and that was in a federal court or one of the court cases recently. It's embarrassing, but unfortunately some people succumb to that, and it gives us a very bad reputation. So the next one was the effectiveness of gauging and managing the immigration risk in the student visa caseload, including the suitability of the assessment level. We have four assessment levels. The fourth assessment level four is the highest. Assessment level one is the lowest. If you're assessment level one, such as the Brits, etc., you've got a lower evidentiary burden when you apply for a student visa. If you've got an assessment level four, you've got a higher evidentiary burden. It doesn't mean that people don't find their ways around it. Compliance measures, how to prevent the misuse of the program and deter breaches of visa conditions. Oh gosh, that's a big ask when you think that there's 650,000 international students, and you know, you've got 22 million customers per annum as a department. You've got 7,000 bureaucrats, it's a global village, etc., etc., and there's a lot of vested interest groups. And then the suitability of the various visa categories, because with student visas, you've got a school student visa, vocational education, higher education, postgraduate, AusAid, non-award and student guardians, etc., etc. So, okay, so that's giving you a bit of an overview, and boy, am I talking fast, I know. Okay, I did want to straddle a fair bit. I wanted to basically talk to you about this slide, because it basically, it illustrates the point I'm making. What happened in Australia was that historically we would have a permanent residency program. So people came in, by and large, as permanent residents. By virtue of changes to migration law and policy, and particularly with international education, increasingly students came in as the numbers grew and fewer wanted to depart. We had an impact on what was perceived to be the number of people currently entering Australia. And this created some concerns amongst the community that we were being overwhelmed by foreigners. But really, when you look at the notion of net overseas migration, and you take out those that are going to depart, and those that Australians that leave Australia and go overseas for some considerable period of time, the net gain in terms of population is not so overwhelming. But in any event, this particular slide gives you some understanding of the permanent residence visas. So that would be those, that blue line, and you can see how that's changed over the years, and you can see the visa categories that bring in permanent residency, the skill stream and a family stream. They're capped. What that means is there's a quota. Then you've got uncapped, the New Zealanders, they can come in and out as they like, as many as they want. And then you've got the largely uncapped, and that's your students, which is roughly about 650,000, your temporary workers, which is about 100,000, your working holiday makers, which is about just under about 970,000. And these are the people who, whilst numerically significant for a nation the size of Australia, have created the largest difficulty for the Department of Immigration, particularly the international students, because of the anomalies of the General Skilled Migration Program and many of those wanting to stay and not leave. The next slide again is a very good slide, because can you see here, it basically shows how many temporary migrants hope to remain in Australia. So historically, if you look at over the years, the students would come in, they would leave, and that would make the program a lot more manageable. But more recently, particularly from 2006 onwards, and remember I talked about the change to the general school migration rules on the 1st of September 2007, and the opposite of what the department intended came to be, and that was that the modal was used and manipulated in a way that wasn't really intended. What you've ended up with is a very large cohort of international students looking to stay in Australia one way or another, and the government has tried to deal with it by giving them basically the 4-8 visa, which gives them an 18-month stay, blah, 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 if they don't get permanent residency. Now, these other visa programs are interesting because it tells you, for example, Australian residents. They're Australian residents, but look at how many leave. You know, so we actually have a flow out and we also have a flow in. A lot of Australians, they're young Australians, want to work abroad, or they could be older Australians who decide to go back to their home country of origin to die or whatever. So this is a very, very fluid situation. You've got your temporary, your working holiday visa makers. It's interesting that they should also be leaving, etc. So, and then you've got your skilled migration program and your family migration program, which, as you can see, family reunion is not significantly large, and yet, as I say, we are a nation of immigrants, and a lot of migrants would like to be reunited with close family members. Why am I showing you this slide? Well, it's very difficult to try and explain what the flow-through effects of Australia's migration program is without some sort of diagram which shows you the movement or the flow of people. And this basically gives you your students departing permanently in the permanent and long-term movements. The Department of Immigration is phenomenal in the capturing of data. Where I think it's been a bit lacking, and I've recommended to them to do so, is they should have a mechanism where they should not be granting any one nationality a very large number of visas in one area. You know, if you know that you've got 58,000 Indian students applying for Kukri, you've got to know that something's wrong with the system. Have a look at it and address it, because whilst it might make money for the vocational education provider sector, it's going to result in a lot of people hopefully wanting to stay in Australia, but that's not really what we want. We want them to go home after they finish their education, unless they're the sort of individuals that we want as part of our general skilled migration. So here you can see that, you know, here these are the students permanently departing, and you see how it is. The sort of the growth, but look at that in the context of the growth of the program. The program has grown, and at the end of the day, what the government wants is the students under the current regime, the students to come to Australia, to study in Australia, to go home, to be hopefully ambassadors for Australia, because they will get a quality education which is delivered with integrity, and those few that are entitled to meet the permanent residency rules to do so. But I'll give you another example. I'm very privileged to have access to a lot of governmental information. On the 8th of February 2010, the Minister changed the rules in regard to general skilled migration and announced that a lot of the students who are here currently would not be eligible for permanent residency. In March 2010, 1 month later, there was a 44% increase in spouse visas lodged on shore. A lot of international students married. Do I blame them? I make no value judgment. I'm simply giving you information. Draw your own conclusions. So I guess if I conclude, and I'm mindful of time, we're a lucky country. We need migration. We need international education. It's obviously very important to Australia. Like anything that's lucrative, we've got to be a bit careful about, but not being too greedy, making sure it's sustainable. It is quality, it's delivered with integrity, that we don't dilute things just because of short-term gain, that we don't use it as a mechanism to address the shortfall in the revenue and the financial support that we provide to education, full stop, and that we try and understand both the short and longer term effects of our policies, and understanding that the Department of Immigration is just one little cog in the wheel. Whilst it's very important because it determines who gets the visa, and it's often in the public limelight, it is subject to enormous pressure. And currently, obviously, Michael Knight is grappling with the pressure of the international education industry, many of whom are saying, well, we need that dollar, we need that foreign revenue, it is a fantastic export earner, we want more international students. If it's not sustainable, then we ought to think again. And so I'm going to ask you to finish your reflections tonight in regard to making your own decision about this. I've thrown a lot of things at you. Please don't assume any of them are my personal perspective. I was just hoping that a lot of you would stay awake during the bulk of the evening. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed, Maria. Now, it's always great to hear an enthusiast, isn't it? And certainly Maria is an enthusiast. So who would like to ask the first question? Yes.
Thank you, Michael. Bill Pickford of the Institute. One of the major problems with the education system is obviously the abuse and the arriving of totally unqualified people in the industry, which causes immense grief to us for our standards, the drastic disappointments of the students and their families who stake up the money to get these kids a so-called education, which is a bodgy one. With only 7,000 people in the department, how can they ever hope to adequately police this in conjunction with an education department?
Well,
make it effective.
Yeah. Well, look, you know, your state and Commonwealth regulators, when they're registering somebody to be able to sell a course or to provide a certain education to international students, they are meant to meet what's called 15, the national code. That consists of 15 standards. That includes the quality of the education, the quality of the teachers, the quality of the facilities, the quality of the library, the quality of the accommodation, etc., etc. Probably what happens is that that's perhaps not carefully scrutinised, or perhaps when they apply to register, all of it looks good, but perhaps in reality doesn't deliver. And that's really been a question as to the audit and monitoring that occurs in the course of an education provider's life in Australia as to whether in fact they are adequately, I'm going to use the word decidedly, policed in terms of whether they deliver what they say they will. And often the students have got very poor bargaining power, they don't know what to expect, and they'll settle for a lot less than they should. Yes. But I think it's for everyone to speak out and to say, look, that's just not good enough, and to demand high standards. And that requires us as individuals to lobby government and say, forget about the profit motive and look at the long-term implications for us as a nation.
Yes.
Tim Healy. Thank you for that. My head is spinning a bit with all the amount of information. But it seems to me that a lot of the problems come down, and you touched on this, to the question of the funding of education, the underfunding is the many of the institutions. And so, and they're in a terrible dilemma. If you're Melbourne University, you want to be continue to be in the top, in the league table. So you want high standards, but to 30%, whatever it is, short of funding to do that. So there's a terrible dilemma about trade-off between quality and charging. Melbourne University is about to introduce courses called doctorates for people who've done coursework, master's degree, and charge whatever. For the lesser universities, it's even worse. So we come back to the problem, particularly through the 90s, I think, with the underfunding of education institutions. We're forced into selling their wares and dumbing down. I don't know, maybe you've already commented on that.
Look, I think you're absolutely right. That's exactly what has happened. And I'm a bit old-fashioned. I don't think I can reconcile education with profit. I don't know, but it's always very, it's a very good mix. Education is education, it's learning, it's developing locational skills, a capacity to think about the world in a certain way, to go out there and be able to be productive and earn a living. I'm very concerned about the calibre of the graduates, because at the end of the day, you know, we who are employers, are we actually getting somebody who's actually qualified in a certain thing, or did they buy their way through it because the profit motive encourages certain providers to push students through because the consequences of failing too many is just not acceptable, because they, you know, it will impact the bottom line. So I think we've got some real moral challenges that we have to address as a nation. I don't have any answers, but I would certainly be asking government to consider that any nation that's going to survive in the 21st century, particularly one which is a smaller population as us, must invest in education first and foremost for our own, and then hopefully to also then have a program where we allow a certain number of foreign students to come here, but offer them value for money, genuine education. It's not a soft ride. Yes.
Yeah, down the back.
I'm working for education. We started in international because there seemed to be a lot of opportunity there, and moved into domestic to get away from the rampant BS in the international area. I've seen audit teams come out of the state-based regulatory bodies that go and register audit for RTOs and craftless licences. No one answers the phone in these departments because they're so understaffed. They had to outsource to Grant Thornton, who was
yes.
accountants, because they didn't have enough auditors.
Yes. And you know, think about what that costs, the premium that you charge.
I turned up an RTO last year, which one day there was a wall, and the next day there was a hole in it with a door with a disabled sign on it, because they'd been picked up not having a disabled toilet. So overnight a group of Indian tradesmen had come in, knocked a hole in the wall, and bang, we've got we're compliant because we've got a disabled toilet. They don't meet the requirements. It is a patch job over crap.
And you know what's even worse is this, that in response to the fiasco that we had predominantly with Indian students that I touched upon earlier, there was an act passed which was also by the Department of Education at Commonwealth level, where all private vocational education providers had to be re-registered, and that was by the 31st of December 2010. Interestingly, someone who's a representative of a private education provider rang me today and said that I wouldn't believe how many shonks are still operating that don't actually offer any education to students, that kids don't even turn up, they just get their piece of paper. So it is, again, it's a question of political will and resources. I don't know if one was cynical, perhaps we don't want to close down too many providers. It might affect the fact that it's Victoria's largest source of export earner. Question mark. Look, I'm a bit disheartened, but I'm also very privileged to work at the upper echelons of international education with perhaps higher calibre providers. Yes. Yeah, so I don't have a solution, I'm sorry, but it is a perennial challenge, and we don't have adequate regulation.
Frank Marlowe, member of the Institute. Can you differentiate where the most shonky work is taking place? So, for example...
Dodge is the word we like, actually.
Are the universities basically, the accredited universities basically doing a good job?
Look, you know, it's not my job to slate anyone. Can I say that the sort of practical, pragmatic side of me would say that if I'm selling something and I've got a large number of consumers and they become a vested interest group and a powerful lobby, then regardless of what my standing is as an education provider, I'm probably going to succumb to pressure from time to time. I believe that it impacts on the quality of standards overall. My own view, however, is that the universities have been better at meeting that challenge because they've got a critical mass, they've got a longer period of learning, infrastructure, their institutions, their bigger organisations, the rot takes longer to flow through, but they're not invincible. And I think it's incumbent upon anyone involved with the universities to continue to fight an ever vigilant fight to maintain both the quality and the integrity of the education.
I presume most of your 52,000 in the university.
They would be private education vocational providers, by and large. By and large. But look, again, there are some high calibre ones, and we've got to be very careful about that. You know, you've got the William Angelus Institute of TAFE, which is has got a very high quality hospitality course. You've got other schools that have been known to have high quality courses. But once an industry subsector starts to get tarnished, unfortunately, there can be a perception that it's universal. And we've got to be very careful not to be attacking people who are not here to defend themselves. I'm simply saying that, you know, it's time we really reflected on international education and considered both the benefits and the true costs to Australia and the costs in terms of educating our own.
Tony.
Maria, there's a bit of a vicious circle really in all of this, in that we are still competing for international students with countries such as the United States and Europe for the top quality students in particular. And I think you mentioned early on that the whole issue of quality really relates across the board, not just in terms of the quality education that you mentioned you felt was declining. But why is this declining? Is it because our standards, for example, have been lowered with regard to the kind of people we are able to attract? And given that also, it's also now easier from what I hear, and you can verify that this more than I can. But I do understand that the entry requirements for foreign students now, say in the United States and in Europe too, have been made a lot easier. It's much simpler to get a visa to study in those places than it has been here. Now, I don't know what truth there is in that, but this is something I'm hearing.
Yeah. Look, I'm not in a position tonight to sort of do a comparative analysis as to what the visa regimes are in different countries. One of the things I have read, though, about America is that some of its most prestigious universities tries to attract the brightest by offering them free places. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, that's extraordinary, where you're getting your intellectual giants or the future leaders of society. And these are real names. And that's an extraordinary initiative that you've got that much money that you can actually bring in these people and offer them a free education and, you know, in effect, hopefully retain them as your future leaders. If not, they'll go back to their own home country, but hopefully be your ambassadors and influence things in their own internal affairs, which are hopefully favourable to the country that offers them that educational opportunity. We have that in some way with our international education. But look, I can't comment on that, Tony. It is a global industry. A lot of countries are sort of reviewing their policy setting according to the government of the day. You know, we were in competition with England, and the next thing is England closed its doors because it can't tell who's still lawful amongst the international students, who's unlawful, because they didn't have proper data and border control, so the best thing is to just stop it. America, well, your international education program is only 3%, so it's fairly inconsequential. I understand they're moving towards encouraging a greater number there, but again, you know, in a country such as America, which is what, nearly 300 million, even if you get it up to another, you know, up to 10%, it's fairly inconsequential relative to the numbers, you know, the impact upon us. We're a very small pond, and the impact upon us is much more overt and felt because of the size of our market. But yes, look, I also know, for example, in America you can't work as an international student, whereas here, as soon as you get your student visa and you start studying, you can work. So we offer those benefits. And for the right students, we offer them residency. There's no doubt about it at all, whereas, again, in America, that might be a more difficult regime. So, you know, are you looking at how you attract the students, or are you looking at how you attract them and also offer them some flow-through benefits? We seem to have the upper hand insofar as that's concerned, even with the revised points test, which comes into effect on the 1st of July.
Could you give us a breakdown of or sort of ratios about the source of the countries of origin for these students?
Yeah, look.
And then a gender breakdown within those countries?
I might have to take that as a question on notice, but the Department of Immigration is fantastic at analysing data, and there is, if you're interested, there's a student visa program report 2010-2011 to the 31st of December 2010, and I've got a sort of that's very difficult for me to try and encapsulate, standing on my feet and talking to you, but I can give you a bit of a snapshot from Australian Education International, if any of you are interested. Basically, our highest source country in terms of international education is India. China, followed by India. That's the greatest demand. And if I could find the other bits and pieces of my papers that I've got here, I can then summarise some of the other things in the hope of answering your question in a more concerted way. I'll find it probably as soon as I stop talking. So China will, I think, continue to be a great source country. And can I give you a personal perspective? I think for a lot of Chinese families, Australia's potentially a safe haven. It offers the family a fallback position. If they do want to get out of China, it's an alternate passport which is safe. But whether the family actually ever want to settle here, it really depends on how well to do they are in their own home country. I'm sorry, I had the AIE one, but I can't find it. Anyway, I'm happy to give you a loan of this if you want to read it. So, well over 100 pages of data. I don't think it breaks it up on gender. That's interesting. But it does give you data in regard to the vocational education, the tertiary sector, the ALICOS, which is the English language. We'll look quickly. Citizenship. China, 92.4%. That's the visa grant rate in the last seven financial years, so it's 7 years. So in 2009-2010, 92.4% China, 65.9% India. So they give you tables as to how many students we get from different sectors, and that's a very interesting analysis. And as I say, your source countries would be China, India, South Korea, Thailand, Brazil, and then other countries. America figures fairly high. Japan. Yeah.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, it's coming on to 7 o'clock, and I have a fairly strict rule about finishing at 7 o'clock. But that's the first time we've had a question on notice, I think. and I think the advice that Maria has given you, that they're very interesting publications, those Department of Immigration publications. Maria, you've given us something to think about tonight. I've written down here, now 3,000 pages of law up there with the Taxation Act. And I've written here in big letters, the statistics are boggling, and they really, really, truly are. I wonder how many people here had any idea about the range of people and backgrounds and different categories that we're involved in Australia. It is quite baffling. The cornerstone of Australian economic future, that's a pretty important statement to make, and I think it's pretty true too. And international education, I must admit I hadn't realised that it was such a formidable, and I use the phrase that you used, such a formidable industry. And of course when you look at the numbers involved and the people who are involved in providing these educational facilities, obviously it is a formidable industry. And any government and any members of parliament are going to take a fairly close attention to the views and prospects of people in such a formidable industry. I'm not quite sure how you weed out the profit motive. One of the worst things about not making a profit is you go broke. And in many cases that could be a good thing in some of the things, and I'm not going to instance any one particular group. But I have been horrified, as Bob Birrell talked to us at some stage before about some of the practices of those offering industry training for people from overseas, and the lack of opportunity and the absence of proper training that these people were provided with or not provided with, and simply they were there to hand over their money, and that should be stopped. And if the government of at the state levels and at the federal level haven't got the intestinal fortitude to do that, then they sell themselves and this country very short indeed, in my view. So thank you very much indeed for bringing this to our attention. I found it absolutely terrific. And now we're going to provide you with a bit of reading, because this is your first time here.
May I
give you, present you this short history of the Institute. Next time you come, you'll get a bottle of wine, which is even better.
Thank you very much for being such a patient audience.
It being 7 o'clock, I declare the meeting closed.